Hello and welcome to Unwatchables, your last chance to vet the movies you're scared to watch or process the ones you wish you didn't. I am Mark Tatavio.
I'm Seth Troyer.
And today we're discussing two art films whose explicit and sometimes unsimulated sexual content caused some to accuse them of being pornography. We are starting with Nagisa Oshima's widely banned 1976 erotic true crime story In the Realm of the Senses, followed by the film that did for Watermelon what Call Me By Your Name did for Peaches, that is Tsai Ming Lang's 2005 surrealist love story, The Wayward Cloud. Put on your trench coats, we're going to the movies.
Ugh, you never fail to add on the little end of the trailer tag.
The stingers.
You can take that out if you want.
Don't you dare.
No, it's Stan.
All right. Well, I want to start out by introducing our very special guest. We have with us Paul Keelan from the film podcast Cinematic Underdogs. Paul, it's so nice to have you.
Hey. What's up, guys? Stoked to be on here. That was an excellent intro, man.
Thank you.
Perfectly said.
So, we're kind of like friends on Letterboxd, you know, see each other's reviews and stuff for quite a while. And then I, you know, saw that Paul actually had his own podcast. Is there anything you want to tell us about Cinematic Underdogs? First of all, how long has that been going on for?
Yeah, we started it right after the pandemic hit. It's my childhood best friend, still best friend, and I, it's like side project hobby. We have a weird niche because I'm definitely into films that you guys cover. I like weird, unwatchable, heady, like cinephile adjacent shit. But we do sports movies, which is probably one of the most middle brow genres in the world. Specifically underdog sports movies, specifically weird tangents, because I don't always want to stay within our confines of the sports genre. So we do lots of like peripheral sports movies like Cliffhanger or post-apocalyptic ones like The Running Man or Death Race 2000. Like, I'm always trying to stretch it however I can to get cool shit on there. But there's something really fun about a traditional feel-good sports movie as well, especially when you like dig into the formula a lot. It's this weird like semi-post-structural exploration of like what holds genre together, I guess I would say. But anyways, yeah, we've been doing it about 2 years. We're rounding, I think, 80 episodes or somewhere in that realm, lost track. And it's been fun. We've had a great bunch of guests. You guys are invited anytime. And yeah, it's been a blast. It's just a total side project for the both of us. But it's been nothing but fruitful in terms of like building relationships with cool movie lovers like you guys.
I love it.
I love that.
All right. Well, let's dive right in then, because we do have an episode of this podcast where we talked about actual adult films during the golden age of porn in the 70s. But these are not that. But, you know, maybe someone has a different view about where exactly the line is between something that is pornographic or just erotic.
I think they're for adults.
All definitely for adults. Yeah. But these are through and through art films, generally critically acclaimed, but have unsimulated sex, at least in the first movie that we're going to talk about, which is In the Realm of the Senses from 1976. And this is by Nagisa Oshima, who is one of the major directors of the Japanese New Wave, which was kind of a loose category from like the late 50s through the end of the 70s. Not that dissimilar from like the French New Wave, where basically they were exploding the conventions of not just filmmaking, but the kind of subject matter that they could explore, the kind of ideologies that they could represent. And there's a bunch of radical and just really cool films from that period. I was kind of going through a list to see what is really technically considered canon in the Japanese New Wave, and some movies that I really love are in there, like Woman in the Dunes.
Oh, fuck yeah.
From Hiroshi Teshigahara. Yeah, that's probably that's one of my favorite movies, probably. But there's also cool stuff by like Masaki Kobayashi, like Kwaidan, which is like an anthology horror film or ghost story, kind of, which I might pop in again maybe sometime this Halloween. He did some other classic samurai films like Harakiri and Samurai Rebellion. And there's one I just recently watched called Double Suicide from 1969 by Masahiro Shinoda. And these are very experimental, lavish looking films. Double Suicide in particular is almost part theater, where they have like stage hands coming on screen, and a lot of really cool stuff coming out of this period. And Oshima is one of the major figures, if not the major figure, as far as the volume of movies from there.
I didn't know he directed Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
Yes, with David Bowie.
Yeah, David Bowie and Ryuichi Sakamoto, who is an amazing musician in his own right. Yeah, that's a great movie. I didn't know it was the same guy as Realm of Senses.
That's wild, actually. They had a clip from the Realm of the Senses at the very end of Moon Age Daydream. And they had a ton of clips of David Bowie traveling Japan in that. So,
oh, wow.
It's a freaky movie, man.
Yeah.
It's a freaky movie.
I've only seen one other. I haven't seen Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, although I'm kind of interested in it now. But I have seen Violence at Noon from 1966.
What a cool title. He's got some killer titles, this guy.
So, yeah, great. A very exciting scene at the time. But even in 76, a movie like this would probably have been pretty shocking.
I was shocked when they had that bit at the very end, you know, the voiceover explaining like she went from inn to inn with his member in her hand, grinning radiantly, like maniacally. I was like, oh, this sounds like a true story. And then I looked it up and realized it indeed was like the Japanese, what, Lorena Bobbitt, whatever.
And that'll definitely affect whether you consider that a spoiler or not going in, because if you were a Japanese audience, especially around this time, you probably would have known that this was based on one of their most famous true crime cases. And knowing that or not knowing that definitely is going to affect how you view this film, I think, from the very beginning.
Especially selling it to non-Japanese audiences is the other thing. It's just like, I wonder what wound up getting in the door first as far as the conversation was concerned, because like both things are very hair-raising, but like, really, it's like enough just to have like it be full of nudity and it be this notorious, like, is it a porno? Is it not a porno kind of thing in the US at least, or Europe, to get it like banned or get it talked about in certain ways, let alone it being this like intense murder.
Yeah, this would have been something really well known at the time. I mean, probably still now. It happened in 1936, and it's really close to exactly what we see in the movie. The characters have the same names as the real life people. I believe it's Sada Abe, who is a Japanese sex worker who basically started working at a restaurant and started an affair with the restaurant owner. And a lot of the things we see in the film with them being holed up for days, having sex and pushing each other further with erotic asphyxiation, and even with the maids and servants all stepping around them and serving them sake while they don't want to stop having sex. And then all the way to her. And again, it's a little, now that the cat's out of the bag, you know, the real story ends with her strangling and then castrating her lover. And I guess what captured the imagination, besides that this was this just wild, transgressive story and people were projecting a lot onto it, but the quote I came across as far as an explanation was that, quote, she had killed not out of jealousy, but out of love. And that's something to go into too, I guess, is exactly where we think this character is coming from. Both these characters are coming from, as far as this movie goes. But there's absolutely a true story element, and it is kind of strange at the end when suddenly there's this text and like a voiceover narration and like this happened afterwards, like all of a sudden we're watching like Aaron Brockovich or something.
Yeah, no, these are all good questions that have been brought up, specifically the one about whether it's pornography or film, right? And the fact that it straddles the line of those two mediums, I guess we can call them. It'd be weird to call them genres, but because they're like almost different, like their intentions are very different, right?
Sure.
And yes, there's unsimulated scenes, but there's a psychological component to In the Realm of the Senses that you will be hard pressed to ever get from like a porn film. And furthermore, there's subtext, there's semiotics, there's symbolic systems, and there's, I would say, a commentary on like the human condition that is quite deep, if not deeper than most films, in my opinion. So I'm glad we brought this all up. I apologize if I spoiled anything. I didn't know about if you guys have spoiler rules or not on here.
We don't have rules. That's the thing about it. So, and really, it really isn't much to the plot synopsis of this. So jumping around really kind of I don't know, it feels almost warranted.
A very brief synopsis, since there is very little plot to this movie, is basically the true story that I described, where we have this sex worker who's kind of apprenticing at this restaurant and starts an affair with the owner there. And they very quickly just go into a series of sex scenes. And there's very little in this movie outside of them being isolated together and pushing the boundaries of having sex. There's a few little breaks where she goes off to travel somewhere or has sex with a client, and he does visit his wife at one point, but all of those scenes involve sex generally as well, but they always end up back together. And that is what is unusual structurally about this movie, is it's not just, you know, even the actual adult films that we've watched that will have the sex scenes interspersed throughout as kind of like the punchlines or the action scenes, the kind of thing that's expected. In this movie, it's the whole body of the film, and we really don't get any character development outside of the sex scenes, and really very little context, I think, once they're in there. So that is the whole modus operandi of this movie, is anything you learn about them are through them having sex with each other, or the people watching them having sex, or being pulled into having sex with them at different points.
You initially start out with a very timid feeling coming from the sex worker. The first sexual encounter is instigated by the man, which, if you look at, like, by the end, it is, like, crazy. It's, like, something I forgot, actually, when I went back and looked at the beginning of the movie, because what happens is, like, more and more, as much as he is sort of this seemingly like a dom character, like very much he's the head of the house, he's the one buying her, basically, or she's the mistress on the side or whatever, she is slowly taking control of the situation, and it slowly becomes very apparent that she is the one driving things into really uncharted territory. His role is basically to say yes to her increasingly like intense ideas.
Yeah, I love that. I love the way you guys are mapping this out or charting it, because in many ways too, it's kind of like an addiction narrative or like a druggy movie, right? It has similarities to Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream almost in that sense. There's like a crescendoing element to this film, and its action is each sexual encounter and the way that those dynamics evolve and build and shift and become more and more deranged or perverse or power dynamic entrenched in a way that also, I think, brought to mind, let's say, Phantom Threat, which is a very twisted love story about mutual obsession mixed with control, envy, desire, almost a primal instinctual stripping of self-care and self-image. Like, this movie gets really deliriously kinky at the end, or like in the final act, in like, you know, the scene with the old woman, right, where she pisses herself. Like, they are literally like bereft of mores anymore. They're like outside of the realm of like civility in a really fascinating way, and they're pushing each other there, right? They're like almost daring each other, but it feels very intuitive. It doesn't feel like it's just one-upmanship for like bravado or like, you know, to like showboat or prove themselves. It feels like they are in a like spiral intentionally that's driven by this hedonic impulse that like is bigger than them, and that like strips them of their humanness, right? Of their like rationality, of their like post-enlightenment self. And they're returning to like a more like savage state. And it really, I think, does a tremendous job of capturing that movement. It's almost operatic in a sense.
There's a definite escalation. And again, I mean, one of the reasons this is on this particular podcast is because, I mean, right from the get-go, you know, we're seeing that there is actual penetration happening here. We've actually talked about a lot of movies with cum shots in them on this podcast. It's become kind of a running theme. We get the same thing here. I would say this is, I mean, the most explicit film that we've talked about outside of the pornography episode since, I don't know, Ken Park. That was the main thing that came to mind, where you could tell there was some real sex going on there.
Yeah, she puts eggs in her pussy and Did we watch him go in, watch him come out?
That's one of the more, notorious scenes from this film, because that sense of escalation, it kind of starts a little smaller with she doesn't want him to even leave to pee, and she just tells him to pee inside her, which wasn't clear to me if they ended up successfully doing that or not, but I think that they were trying to, or maybe they did.
I believe in them. I think they did.
Okay.
You believe in them.
I know at one point that was the first thing that got the censors up in arms was a pretty straightforward thing where he, is pulling his fingers back and she's been menstruating and there's blood on his fingers and, they go right into his mouth.
And he licks it.
At a certain point, he's dipping food into her vagina and eating it. And that's where the whole egg thing comes in, which again, we see in full close-up of it going in, staying in, coming back out. You could see this getting under people's skin at a certain point. Even if you do find parts of it erotic, there is still then a kind of a line it goes over where she is threatening him with a knife. They're starting to choke each other, and she cuts off some of his pubic hair, puts it in her mouth. I guess I'm a little interested to see is how actually erotic anybody does find the movie, because it does keep pushing buttons in that way where it keeps going a little too into territory where it gets a little gross. It gets a little non-erotic, but I don't know where you guys ended up on that.
I'm a little bit of a freak. I wouldn't necessarily enter in all of the twists and turns with these two if I was their third, especially towards the end. Goes without saying,
Right.
Because I'm still here. But even the parts that I don't find personally erotic or like things that I wouldn't personally do myself, what really draws you in here is a thing that I think most people, if they're really paying attention or are really in touch with themselves, we've all had that. If we're lucky and are not living under rocks, like we've had that honeymoon period with someone where we've just exploded sexually with someone. We're just like totally and emotionally, like on many levels. And I think that's happening here. And it really does shut out. You do start to shut out the world together. It's like the two of you in this, and it's and you want to just like do whatever the person wants and explore each other in such intense ways. And it's hard not to put yourself in that. I do like what Paul said about it being comparative to Requiem for a Dream or Trainspotting. I think anyone, even if you're not, if you haven't done like heroin or like drugs or anything like that, you can put yourself in that scenario though, where you've had that like youthful, big, bold experience where you've been head over heels for something, like the first parts of those movies are and the first parts of this movie are.
If there's one motif, right, it's pushing boundaries, and it's pushing boundaries together in a playful way. And there's something very playful about these two throughout the film. Even when it turns dark, it's incredibly playful. There's something very non-homicidal about the ending as well. Like it's almost like the ultimate consummation. It doesn't feel extremely violent in my opinion. And I understand that could be quite unorthodox or unconventional for other people. But it feels like the natural escalation of the trajectory that they're on. Yeah.
It totally tracks.
Yeah. So it's extremely dark, but some of the peripheral elements, I think, to me, were the most bizarre and slightly disturbing. The scene with Sada, when she's like picnicking with their children and they're running around, I thought they were getting at this very Edenic moment. And then it ends with one of the, if not the most disturbing scene in the film, where she tugs on her son's privates in a very, very strange way. And I don't have a clue what that was saying. I thought it was trying to say that she's like in this state, or they are in this state of almost, in a bizarre way, paradisical, like innocence. And it was like sort of mapping that onto like a childhood state by showing her with their children who are running around naked, like a boy and a girl together, right? And this purity. But then it goes there. So there are a lot of really disturbing elements to me on the periphery of this film.
Oh, that scene was so disturbing. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And it just cuts like after she grabs the boy. And yeah, it's definitely, I like what you said. I think that is what's going on, is like, because what's happening with the two is that they're going into this like primordial, childlike, ageless zone where everything is like just pure and permissible to them, including something like that, which, you know, it's like starting to show the seams of, okay, once this leaks out of the bedroom is where it gets dangerous, right? For at least other people, if not for them. And yeah, there's also that scene with the, yeah, the maid where it's, he basically rapes her to punish her for he says something wrong to Sada. She does, I mean. And he just like fucks her right there. And it's really like, again, it just cuts after that, keeps going. Cause which I think just maps and follows sort of their trajectory mentally, which is just sort of like one thing after another. And there's only them. And we just cut to yet another scene with only them, you know?
Yeah, there's a few different times where she basically is ordering him to have sex with one of the servants. And sometimes it definitely doesn't seem consensual. Another time it's a lady who says she's like 68 years old. And it seems like it's meant to be a degrading thing, the way that they're talking about it. And I definitely want a third that I by far found the most disturbing scene to be the one with the children, which almost, I mean, goes a little bit past just the content of what's actually in the movie, because there's at least three different scenes that involve children. And there's one early on where there's this hobo on the street and this little girl is like poking at his penis, and they're clearly in, like, the actors are all in the same shot and actually there. And same thing towards the end, where Sada wakes up in some sort of concrete stadium or something with benches all around her, and there's a little girl who is walking around her and looking at her while she's naked. And the scene where, you know, she grabs a little boy, he clearly starts going like, ouch, ouch. And oh, I almost went just too far into like, I'm not sure how responsibly this movie even could have been made with those particular scenes in them. But it's interesting that those will stand out among all of the other depraved things that we see happen.
One of the most remarkable scenes, if not the most indelible scene of the film, is Ishida walking down the street in the opposing direction of the like Japanese Imperial Army. It's almost as if like they're saying something about, I don't know, about the liberation of this individual against the fascism of the masses. But then they're also unafraid to say that there's like a violent madness within the individual, or within the, like, not that he saw the obsistic, right? But he's almost in his own bubble. And then there's these mass movements of violence, these mass movements of destruction and madness. And here he is going against that, but he's also consumed by it. He's also like embedded within like the depravity of the human condition as well. I don't know. I found that moment to probably be, I think, one of the boldest in the films, because it says so much so vaguely, and it gives it this grand context suddenly that the film lacked before, right? Before that moment, it was all very contained, and that opened up the doors to so much. I want to just open it up to you guys as well. Like, what did you take from that expansion of the narrative?
That's definitely the scene that I think most people point to when they won't try to put this into some kind of societal or cultural context, because that really is all that we get. And personally, I kind of wish there was a little bit more of that, or more of a sense of exactly what they're being isolated from. Because, I mean, this is a very straightforward movie, stylistically, narratively, and the main effect I think it gives you is just, you know, what's it like to go from the beginning to the end with such just extended sex scenes, and you have the whole runtime to think about your feelings about it and just juxtapose it being such a high volume of that. And I guess I probably would have gotten a little more out of it if there was more of a sense of what exactly is looming outside that they're either escaping, or exactly psychologically where they're coming from. Because, I mean, you could look at it in the cultural context, but also just psychologically, we don't get a lot from either of these characters, I don't think. Maybe you guys disagree. I think that when it comes to the two actors in particular, we have Tatsuya Fuji as Ishida, and he does have this kind of nonchalant attitude towards everything. His reactions are kind of ambiguous that you could read into them, where, you know, when she says, "I'm going to kill you," and he says, "Go ahead, kill me," you wonder, does he really mean that? Is it just play to him? Is it more than that?
I love how opaque that is, yeah.
And I feel like he was able to bring that kind of to the character. What kind of surprised me is Eiko Matsuda, who plays Sada, has almost no filmography outside of this movie. Like, I was trying to see anything else that she had done, and there's really very little. And I guess I didn't feel the same complexity necessarily from her. It was all very outward. There was jealousy there. There's lust, possessiveness. For lack of a better word, it's just kind of like a sex maniac who is immediately very attached to him. And I don't know if maybe that's more coming from the film or from the performance, that it would have needed somebody to really dig in deep to try to suggest more than I got from there. So I wish I got more of a sense of her, of how much of this was love or possessiveness, or even if there is supposed to be ambiguity there, or if this is something to do with her own oppression or repression. And the movie does not give you a lot, and I think sometimes that can be mysterious in a good way, and then some other times she almost seemed like more simplicity to her character than would have gone. But I just covered a lot of ground there, I guess, as far as the themes go in this movie, so I want to hear what you have to say, Seth.
See, for me, I think what helps about it being opaque and a little blank in some areas helps you impose your own ideas and your own experiences onto these two. Because for me, I just can't help, and maybe it is a personal thing, I can't help but just watching my own like sexual id or lack of id like being split in two into these two characters. And we have the me that like has all sorts of like ridiculous ideas, maybe at some like base level. And then the me who has to either say yes or no to it. And that's the male character in this situation, who's, again, like I go back to, it does feel like his job as a like a mechanism for her is the person being there to say yes, to allow for her to create her like wild world, sort of, which I think that's why she's like wanting him so much. It's like, it's not so much him, it's just what he permits and what he allows. And he's like swept up in that. All he has to do is nod and the wildest thing will occur in front of him that he's like probably never seen before, especially by the end, you know, like never seen such devotion, commitment, debasement, like whatever you want to call it. These two characters are like whatever we would have had of them as far as like developing them outside of the bedroom. Like the bedroom is slowly deconstructing them. They are like deconstructing like throughout the narrative. So I think even if we had something more at the beginning to hold on to of them, it's kind of gone by the end.
Yeah, I love a lot of the words you brought up and the ideas and themes you brought up. Like the basement, I feel like, is the modus operandi of their relationship as well, right? It's almost like this competition to see like who can debase the other more and more and more. And simultaneously, the willingness to be debased. I thought at times of Allen Ginsberg's How, right? And the famous line about like being subject to like a truck driver in a gas station. I don't know if anyone knows that line, our audience knows that line, but it's about like ultimate debasement. And I definitely think that they're getting at the same sort of like eternal liberation that comes from utter and complete vulnerability. Like this is not just like being susceptible to humiliation. This is being like completely at the whim of another being. And that's a frightening and terrifying thing, but it's also like the ultimate act of devotion, right? And so they're almost testing each other. And what I am so glad that this movie didn't do was at the beginning, I was very concerned that it was just going to be a master-slave dialectic and that she was just trying to like sort of woo him and trap him, I guess, in a ruse to like gain power or money, right? That would be the more modern take, right? It would be this like usurpation of like the patriarch or of the male figure and his seat of power, a dethroning of him, which is interesting. I'm not sure saying like it's completely bereft of worth or entertainment or intellectual intrigue, but I think this is so much more interesting, right? This goes into like von Trier territory, for example, like his types of films, like Nymphomaniac, or, you know, like all of the greats. It reminds me of the type of stuff Haneke wants to explore. this is about the will to as you said, like self like annihilation in a very externalized way, in a very outward way, and in a very fleshly way. And it's a question, like, is it violence? Is it love? Is it this weird paradoxical synthesis of the two?
I'd say there is not a like sex scene in any of the movie that is just frivolous or just for the sake of pushing a taboo. I would say that any of these could be defended as far as like character development is going on or something else is going on in the actual scene beyond just the, whether it's eroticism or debasement.
Yeah, I definitely don't question the director's intentions here. And I really don't see how a serious, you know, film viewer could watch this and dismiss it as pornography or however they want to, or obscene or any of the things that it was accused of, because this is just the kind of things that movies can show us that maybe we're a little more used to now. So yeah, I definitely don't think that this is just about shock tactics or anything, or the things that are shocking are meant to be presented in a plaintive way and with a purpose. And if nothing else, the movie makes a virtue of not looking away from the beginning and the end of what it's of these things that it's showing you. I think that maybe the reason I'm a little, I don't know, was left a little less affected by this, and it sounds like maybe you guys were, is just that it didn't seem like it looked quite deeply enough into that. And maybe that's just because I wanted more context in order to put this in. So maybe it wasn't quite as you have to bring your own meaning to it. I think in particular that scene with the soldiers marching by is kind of asked to carry a lot of weight in there, that a lot of the meaning that people will bring to it will come just to that. And I would have needed to have a little bit more than that, I guess, to take away a real political message from this. And a part of me wonders if that's because this is so closely tied to the true story of what happened, that we have the same names, a lot of the same, exactly how it ends is pretty much how it seems like it ended in real life. And I almost wonder if this is a little too slavish to just going with the facts of what happened and showing you what that arc would look like. But that's the kind of a thing I have with these true story movies too, a little bit. So they kind of get maybe boxed in a little bit that. And that's why I find it a little jarring too at the end when they start talking about this, like it's a true story and telling you what happens next and everything.
Yeah.
It's like, did we really get to the bottom of this, or were we just kind of presented with what it would look like?
Yeah, for me, it feels like a true story, like true crime movie that like got out of hand or something in the director's, once he got it going or something, he found something more interesting in the exploration of something more abstract than the actual events, than the actual time period and all that. Because yeah, I did see that soldier scene. I kind of forgot about it. I like a little bit more understanding of it. I don't really know what it's really saying. I kind of like rolled my eyes for a second. I was like, oh God, are they going to make this like a big political metaphor of some sort, like of some very like isolated incident in Japanese history or something, which I would just be like, I don't know. I would not be interested in, because like I was more interested in a wider swath. But by the end, it does have to like, oh yeah, oh, I forgot. Yeah, it does have to, this was a true story. I forgot. She does cut his dick off and wander around with it.
Which, by the way, I mean, you know, word to the squeamish, we see an extreme close-up that we don't look any further away from that than anything else.
I just love its commitment to make the viewer squeamish and the daringness to make a film of this content. Like, it's easy to be, you know, Marquis de Sade, like, and write about this or something, right? Like, it's so easy to do this in private, but like to actually be on a film set and to create this content is so much more bold and audacious to me. This is a weirdly balanced film in its exploration of the psyche, and that sort of chiasmic back and forth, that ricocheting of power and one-upmanship, right? Like I said, similar to like a PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson, Phantom Thread dynamic, is to me a great form of narrative synthesis. You know, this film is really, I mean, there's side characters that are definitely, I would say, abused and exploited. But when we're looking at the central couple, right, that main dynamic, it's very, there's a equity there in a bizarre way. Like even when she kills him, right, you mentioned that he was very nonchalant, right? He was very dismissive. He was very disarming, right? I think that was their interplay. And that was just his role. And within the structure of this story, I don't think he was like the victim at the end, to be honest. I think it was just a natural progression of their devolution. And so, I don't know. I think that there is so much here psychologically. It's not very literal or surface, which is weird to say because it is such a film about the flesh, right? But it's not like exhibited through dialogue. It's exhibited through the weird psychodynamic territories that this is willing to go.
I like what you're saying about Ishida. I think it is part of the real exciting tension of the movie is watching him like dare to go further. And you're wondering like, is this guy just horny or is there something like deeper here? Which there, I do think at the end, it does kind of feel that way that this guy is like, he has like a wider view that he wants to be just totally, he wants pleasure to replace life, basically. That he's willing to, not necessarily that he, I don't even know that there's much evidence that he hates life necessarily, but that it's worth dying for, to be immersed in pleasure, regardless of the consequences.
He does seem kind of just along for the ride for the most part. And that's almost the kind of, you know, documentary almost style approach to the characters of just showing it as opposed to delving in necessarily to what's in their heads. And you bring up a movie like Phantom Thread, which I love, but that's a very psychologically coherent film and scenario where we know that he is this fastidious control freak who, like a lot of people who end up being, you know, submissive sexually, ends up, if, you know, feeding this other side of his soul, basically, where he can go to bed and be and give up control, but only in this particular way. And I could never land for either of these characters on what where they were coming from in a similar respect. But that's just, you know, that's neither here nor there. It depends on what your preference is of whether you need that for it to come away with something.
Yeah, I was not saying that he's along for the ride. That's what I thought at a certain point. But by the end, I do see it as like he is on a journey just as much as she is.
Yeah, it's intriguing though that it didn't, I think, resonate as much with you, Mark. I find that interesting. I do. It's just, I think that what you're seeing in Phantom Thread though is something that's a little more discursive in the sense that like we get there through dialogue. Like they're kind of disclosing the psychology, and here you do have to like just infer it. And so, yeah, I could be bullshitting. I could be reading it all, right? And you could come through it and actually to completely engage and participate in this film and just not have that experience, right? Because that's the problem with reticence, right? Like the film is very reticent in that sense, right? It doesn't expose itself fully to you.
Ironically. And speaking of exposing though, and the just Oshima being brave with making this movie, because this, you know, Japan had some pretty strict censorship laws at the time. And the way that they got around that was by designating this as a French production, even though it was technically kind of a co-production. And they just shipped over the film and to have it developed and edited in France so that no one there even saw it.
It's his fault. It's not my fault.
And they're still to this day hasn't been released like uncensored in Japan. They had a premiere where they used optical censoring, where they blurred stuff and reframed things.
Oh, that's so depressing.
And Oshima did appear in court to argue that it wasn't obscene and make his case. And he has some very clear, lucid, convincing thoughts about that. But I mean, it took many years to be released uncut in the US, in Germany, in Canada, Australia.
In the 90s.
It was banned in other countries like I think Belgium, Brazil, Israel, like the people did freak out a bit. And there's some places, ironically, Japan itself, where they still don't have an official uncensored release there. Although most of the other countries have come around since then.
I can't help but get a little anti-government hard on about that a movie that is about turning away from everything, including the state and society, and finding it for free in another human being to the point of immolation is like, yeah, that's a very dangerous movie in its own way, right? To powers that be.
Yeah, you perfectly said that. I love that so much. Yeah, I love that about this too, is that it's not just explicit in the sense of like the unsimulated scenes, right? It's explicit in the sense of like what it's saying. It's a very anti-social movie, right? It's a big middle finger film to the government, to the state, to society, and to morals. So yeah, I'm 100% with you on that as well. Well said.
All right. Well then, any final thoughts on this, including even though, as usual, I think I know where everyone's going to land on this, but whether you would unwatch the movie if you could, and anything else you want to use to sum up before we move on to the next film?
Sure. Yeah, I would definitely not unwatch this. I'm glad I finally got to it. It's been on my watch list for ages. I highly recommend it to anyone out there who is looking for something that is unafraid to explore the boundaries of love, violence, and the human condition. So yeah, just try to summate it very cleanly. That's my take. Watch it.
Yeah, no, you're wrong, Mark. I say fuck this movie. It's too many butts. Too many butts in there. No, I'm just kidding. I loved it. I thought it was admittedly very erotic in its own way, and very poignant and beautiful too. It's a great balance. I'm not one of those people who really differentiates like porn from art. I think there's like stuff on Pornhub that is art that has no plot, and there's probably, you know, art movies like this that are totally pornographic to me at the same time. Yeah, there's a lot of great literature that this reminded me of Georges Bataille, Story of the Eye, which is a book that I love, and it reminded me of this, of like, it's even more absurd because, again, it's in the world of literature, so you can just like do the most crazy, insane shit. And I know there's parts of it that I just plain don't understand as far as like what it's saying, but basically Story of the Eye, similar to this, it is like watching two lovers just see how far they can go to turn away from the world and rules and everything in the name of pleasure and decadence and in the end immolation. And yeah, some wild shit. Wild shit.
It's the life that Seth aspires to.
I'm working on it.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I'm into it.
Yeah. So yeah, I would not unwatch this. I think it is of interest and people should definitely give it a shot. And regardless of whether I feel like it ended up doing enough for me to take something away from it, there is a strange integrity to it, seeing this vision all the way through to the end and seeing what you can do by having a movie almost entirely of sex scenes and all the different things that you can take away from it. So I definitely think it earns its art film stripes. That will move us on a few decades into the future to The Wayward Cloud, which is a Taiwanese film from 2005 by Tsai Ming-liang. And I didn't realize until Seth's pointed this out, and he didn't realize this either until it was over, that this is technically a sequel or a quasi-sequel to one of his earlier films. It's called What Time Is It There? And I'm actually am looking forward to watching that at some point, but I did not even realize, or else I might have tried to watch it before this. It sounds like they're very loosely connected, though, that it's the same two characters, but they're in totally different situations when this movie starts.
Yeah, I hear the motifs and things, like water and various other motifs are like very much at the forefront in that movie. I think it's a more narrative, like regularly structured in the real world movie, unlike this one.
Yes.
Yeah. I did hear that it maybe helps. I don't know. Yes.
Maybe.
I was not familiar with his work, but I've been meaning to see like five of his movies for so long. They've all been on my list. Goodbye Dragon Inn and all those.
Yeah. Tsai Ming-liang, I also wanted to watch his films for a long time. Right off the bat, I'm just very pleased to have gotten an entry. And immediately I'm like starved for more. This was a very unique perpendicular film to In the Realm for the Senses, right? It's similar, but not.
The similarities are very superficial. These are extremely different movies. It's really just the the focus on sex that links them, honestly. And I hadn't seen this before we put this episode together, but I do think there's probably some productive avenues we can go towards as far as what one might bring out in the other. But yeah, definitely extremely different.
They both are freaky.
Yeah, they're both very, very kinky, for sure.
They're freaks.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is not an easy film to find, actually, too. It's not readily available on streaming services, as far as I can tell. And you can make up your own mind, you know, if you're listening, if you want to try to seek it out for yourself. It's definitely not as easy to get a hold of as In the Realm of the Senses. And I think that goes for all of Simon Lang's films for some reason. So this stars Lee Kang-shang and Chen Shang-chi, who both are in either all or almost all of his films. I know the male actor here is apparently in every single one of his feature films. And strangely enough, this was a big commercial success in Taiwan and their official Oscar submission for that year.
What?
And I know, I was like, wow, I think that's pretty badass, and maybe I need to get over to Taiwan.
We got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
I've been there. It didn't give off these vibes, that's for sure.
There's not midnight screenings of this year round.
Maybe. There's a little bit of it. There's a little bit of like a seedy grindhouse vibe to some neighborhoods for sure. But I've only been to Taipei, really.
Well, you mentioned Taipei, which is where this takes place. And I'm going to do my best to try and give people an idea of what this movie is about, because it is pretty strange. And we kind of slowly gather information that there's some kind of a drought going on. And we hear over news reports, you know, that they're running out of water, that watermelons in particular have become used for sustenance, and also as declarations of love between young people. There's all kinds of this symbolic kind of weight that is being put on watermelons in kind of a mysterious way throughout this movie. But there's basically two main characters. One who we open with a scene of him kind of having sex with a woman through a watermelon. It's basically the big image that you'll see from this, if you know anything about this movie, where she has this watermelon cut in half and in front of her crotch, and he's fingering it, and then eventually...
See, I think he's having sex with the watermelon. She happens to be there, and it just slips in. I think that's how I do it.
Yeah, she was incidental to the whole thing.
Yeah, I think so.
But we slowly learned that he's actually a porn actor, and he is starring in these pornographic films. Well, at the same time, we have this other character who he kind of meets, and I guess it's referred to from the previous film that they knew each other before, but she doesn't know he's doing porn now, and she is kind of hapless and has a lot of different things going on. There's a kind of a running joke where she's trying to get this suitcase open and is trying to find the keys for it to get it open. And she's going around collecting bottles of water because of the drought. And that's basically it. They run into each other and start kind of a tentative romance, but it always stops short of them having sex. And things kind of spiral off from there. This is a very stylized movie. There's almost no dialogue. There are lots of long static shots that then at different times are interrupted by musical numbers, which allows the characters to be far more expressive and the film visually than it is at any other point.
Right. And then it immediately goes back to being like borderline silent.
Yes. So there's a very casual, almost deadpan kind of surrealism that is going through this whole movie. And in that way, it's very playful. There's actually a lot of comedy in it. I'd laughed several times watching this. Yeah, there's a lot going on here. Does anyone want to start unpacking this crate of watermelons?
I don't.
Yeah, I think we should start off with the establishing shot, actually, because I thought that was intriguing. Like, it's in this underground tunnel, which are very common in Asia, and you just hear those footsteps, and you see one woman walk past, and then you get a second woman carrying a watermelon. I love that you have this watermelon in a public space that not yet has all of the associations you're about to have with this object. It's just this weird totem that the director, screenwriter chose. And I thought that a lot of elements like that, the world building, just to be simple, are really strong in this. The notion of the drought, the idea of water scarcity, maybe the metaphorical element of that, of sort of vacuous, arid culture. like a soulless culture, sort of slowly seep into the textures of the film. And just the resourcefulness of how they use water is brilliant, right? The scene where she's like gurgling water and spitting it into the toilet so that she can flush the toilet later, or the way that they simulate a shower during one of the porn shots, right? By dumping the water into a plastic bottle, right? With holes in it.
One of the funniest scenes of the movie, I thought, them just trying to simulate a shower just by keep pouring these bottles of water, and they eventually run out while the whole time this guy is just fucking with the camera pressed up against him. Lots of low-key stuff like that.
The famous water bottle and cap scene where the cap gets stuck inside the woman. We get the external shot where we are kind of turned into a voyeur slash viewer who could possibly be, let's say, turned on by this. And then it moves to that, and it totally de-romanticizes it or de-escalates the titillation. And we get in a shot between her legs, and we get all the people sleeping in the background, right? And then we get the director coming in to fish out this cap. And it couldn't be any more crude and vulgar in a different sense. There is absolutely nothing sexy about that moment. And I love the way he undercut so many of these shots with the banality of making a film. I don't really know quite where to start, but I think that that conversation is really interesting about this. The way it cuts between these tonally opposite moods to say, like, here's the effect, but here's the cause or the production that creates the effect. And what does that tell us about our fantasies or about our simulations and so forth?
I guess I have to come clean before I say anything, is that because this was rather hard to find, the version that I found that Mark sent me had no subtitles, which I was like, all right, this barely had, they've like said like five things in the last hour. There can't be that much going on as far as the dialogue. Maybe I'm not missing out on much because I have no idea how to find this any more than buying the DVD. And then I looked at the wiki page real quick while I like took a bathroom break, and I was like, there's a dystopia and they don't have water, and which I was like, okay, I'm catching up. But at the same time, I did feel like there's an intentionality to that almost being like a bit of a joke, the fact that that's even like tacked on there, that like so much of this is like, it's a movie about water and not about water in some like greater context necessarily, even like outside of the science fiction realm of the concept. It's like just watching water, that it's a visual movie, just seeing how water interacts with a surface, or seeing how fingers interact with a watermelon, or how it looks on a skin when it's broken open and things like that. So in that way, I found it very sensory, like first and foremost. You who did have the dialogue, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it does give you a lot of crucial context, especially the news report she's listening to, but also just certain things that aren't really funny unless you get that extra thing, like her, the girl who has sex covered in watermelon juice later, like kind of freaks out in an elevator and saying there's ants on me, and you wouldn't know that it was ants attracted to her from the watermelon if you didn't have that information. And
see, Mark pranked me.
There
he
are
sent
things
me
like
the
that.
Same link.
Listen,
that you watched.
There were subtitles
then
on
how
it.
Did
I don't
you
know.
Get the subtitles.
I pressed the subtitle button, man.
I pressed the subtitle button. It said none.
I got to see how this happened. We'll get to the bottom of this. But although I didn't know ahead of time how important it would be or not, but I think the key word though that Paul used was texture. And what I really love is that the symbolism in this movie is all over the place. It's rampant, but it's too strange and oblique to be too on the nose, too insistent. It's all kind of mysterious, and it's all very textural. There's a constant struggle for water and finding ways to wash yourself. There's the stickiness of the watermelon. There's a cum shot in this movie, which it's hard not to see that in relation to, for example, when he finally does dig some keys out of the concrete, which is kind of another running joke where she throws these suitcase keys out the window. And of course, they're downstairs like drilling into the concrete when she's trying to find the keys, and they shoo her away. And then later she comes by and it's paved now. And just one, she's so beleaguered, this poor girl. But he finally does dig out the keys, and then water starts to rise up from the pavement. Or just these long shots of them cooking and these noodles absorbing water and growing big, or having food placed on them and them absorbing the sauce and really dwelling on that. And it does make this whole kind of sensual experience without putting too fine of a point on it. And that just goes all through the movie. And you can kind of relate that to the longing to, you know, the sense of being dry, of being wet, of life and things stagnating and romance. And that's the kind of thing that might drive me crazy in a different context. But here, the way that it has this kind of low-key surrealism going, and it is very much about that experience. I really appreciated this, and that helped me get on to its wavelength to really enjoy it.
Yeah. Also, the use of the watermelons in so many different scenes and contexts and in so many different items or paraphernalia, right? Like, we have literal watermelon, right, in our first opening shot. But then we get our, like, almost terminally repressed or suppressed character, right, who's yearning for touch, who's craving, right, like, that human connection. And you cannot get it. And she's lying on the floor with this, let's call it like a beanbag. It reminds me almost of those Moroccan poofs, right? But it's a watermelon poof, right, between her legs. So there's a mirroring there, right?
Absolutely.
But one is very, you know, centralized or sexualized, I should have said. And the other one is very almost infantilizing, right? Like, I don't know, there's something about her that reminds me of like a kid watching TV, right, with their little blanket or pillow.
Yeah, and it's fake. It's dry. It's an imitation.
Precisely, right? And there's a lot of just jokey moments with watermelons, right? They're all the umbrellas in one of the musical shots, right, where they're on the pagodas on the water are watermelons.
That's the best scene. I love that.
Beautiful, right? All those musicals, they're fun, they're crazy, they're filled with just pure vibrancy and creativity and a very DIY element too, which I loved. One of the things, though, that's both, I think, really fun, but also quite jarring is the way it kind of shifts back and forth between these musical numbers and this narrative, and the two almost simultaneous narratives of the character who's hankering for this, for her neighbor in her apartment, who's the porn star, right? And who feels so lonely and alienated and isolated. That sense of like unrequited, torturous, painful yearning for another that is never consummated is there. And then there's this other person who can't sort of escape the carnal realm, who's almost overindulged in it. And the survey of carnality is almost repulsive to him, you get the feeling of, right?
Yeah, it seems like he has a hard time getting off as the movie goes on too. And it's strange that this relationship develops with lots of these little lovely moments, whether it's him smoking a cigarette from between her toes, or them like walking on each other's feet, or him stretched out between two walls, like holding himself up over a hallway, and she's feeding him bits of watermelon. But they always stop before it gets to them having sex, and it seems like she wants to, and something is holding him back.
Yeah, she is dying for it. She's craving it, right? I think he doesn't want her to be reduced to the objectification both of himself and of the other in his professional world, right? I think there's something actually very romantic in that very visceral, primal scene in the basement of the porn video store, right? Where she's just like clawing at him, and he just like finally puts his shirt over her head, which in a weird way resembles her with the watermelon under her shirt in an earlier scene. I just loved that image-to-image quality that is playing there, right? They're sort of interposed upon each other because you still have that in your memory, but it's not really saying anything specific. But then he does that and then just hugs her in a platonic way. But I don't think it's purely platonic. I think it's it's a his need for affirmation of love. It has to be like platonic, because the other way I think feels bereft of meaning anymore. Like he's oversaturated and she is starving. And I think that that is really what's colliding a lot when they flirt, and what they want out of this relationship couldn't be any more diametrically opposed. They both want each other, but I think for very different reasons.
Yeah. How do you see that, Seth? Because I'm wondering, is this a love story? Is this headed somewhere liberating or dark? I mean, the ending puts things, I think, in a whole different context. We don't have to dive into that right away.
Do I think this is a love story?
Yeah. I mean, how was this relationship? What is like the arc here?
I don't know. This was a little lost on me. And again, I didn't get the dialogue. I was reading the wiki page along with it. But at the same time, I don't know. I think my main problem was the slowness, which I do enjoy slow cinema. I love like Bélatar and like Uncle Boonmi and all that director's movies are like some of my favorite movies. But I think the difference what I am attracted to in minimalism is when it's like elongating the time we spend with something for like maximalist results. And I just was not like feeling that here. I just felt like time was stretching, scenes were stretching, and the same thing was happening like by the end of that scene. I didn't find a lot of it very sexually gratifying, and I think that's kind of the point. It just was like about like sexy things being sort of awkward and being interrupted. I felt like I didn't really have a window into these two characters and like what they wanted or didn't want. I just knew one was like a porn person and the other one was like walking around with a watermelon sometimes and was horny sometimes.
Yeah, it's funny that that's kind of like the reaction I had to In the Realm of the Senses.
That is wild.
And I think we're kind of swapped on these two.
That's crazy. There's so much less to go on here. It's just like, what?
No, because I mean, this, you know, the whole movie, the whole atmosphere is like externalizing what is going on inside. I feel like that's the, you know, from the musical numbers and the way those pop out. And, yeah, and again, it's worth saying that these are...
What are those for?
Well, they're very stylized, and they are surprising because they're these whole production numbers. And, you know, at some point he's running around with a penis helmet on, and there's ladies dancing with plungers and buckets on their heads
they're
and wearing
fun.
Traffic cones.
Not everything has to have a purpose. I'm not saying that. I'm just curious.
Right. It just seems to me like that was the only chance that the characters had to come out and really express themselves in ways that they didn't throughout the movie. And I think that the director did a good enough job of setting up this tone and this rhythm that it all just kind of slides together for me in its own surrealistic logic. So I can't totally place it all together in a neat way, but I did ultimately come away feeling feelings and dynamics between the characters, and whether it was just this elemental contrast of things being barren and dry and water being bottled and trying to get refreshed and things like that. It just worked because of how the director set that all up. And the fact that it was funny went a long way for me, that this movie is playful.
I found it just awkward. I didn't find it very funny. I didn't even realize they were in the musical numbers, the characters.
He was almost in all of them, yeah. And I thought they were quite quirky. This was a very goofy movie. There is a tonal element of like Amelie or something in ways.
Yeah.
But then it would go to much darker places. Like I said, the musical numbers had a John Waters sort of vibe to me. They were like high camp. But they were oddly interspersed into the film. And like you said, Seth, I mean, they could just be there. They don't have to have meaning. But I guess like a little part of me was, I think, irritated by how it's funny. Mark said that they rhythmically work. And I think they do kind of glide with the film very well. But I do think that they feel like creative interludes that are overly abstract and framed and pre-engineered in an inorganic way. I don't know. I just feel like I see the creative element in those scenes too much. I see the artifice too much. I love them independently. I think like they would make for brilliant, just sort of almost background projected videos at a party, or I just can't believe they haven't been more viral, just online, just like in film Twitter, because they're so awesome. But within the tapestry of the film, I don't know, I'm a little bit ambivalent. I'm a little torn. I want to hear your take a bit, Mark, because you seem to have been able to tie it all together, or at least find more out of it. And I always appreciate that.
Well, and yeah, and again, I'm not sure it totally all ties together, but you could argue that the point is for them to stand out in a way that's jarring and artificial in the way that the rest of the movie isn't. And, you know, part of it really is just there are these bursts of energy and light and playfulness that are just appreciated in this context. And maybe you can't justify them. But I think about a work of surrealism like Celine and Julie Go Boating was one that came particularly for me. I can't remember the director's name, a French film. And so much of that movie is absurdity and surrealism, and it kind of feels like stuff they were coming up with on that day, or that doesn't really all tie together. And a lot of it is almost ineffable as to what makes the difference between that being something that works in a particular movie or that doesn't. And I don't know, this, I guess the spirit just kind of worked for me here, and especially the very first time you're so not expecting it to happen, and all of a sudden our main character looks like a merman and is lip syncing. These are all like lip syncing to songs. I don't know if they're standards or something. They all have that kind of feel to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe they are love songs generally.
Yeah, I recognize some of them. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's about as far as I can go. They're not necessarily like my favorite thing about the movie, but I again found them to be something that added to the overall texture, which, like you said, is just very quirky and off-kilter and, you know, definitely mannered. But, yeah, I mean, I was happy that they were there. And they are so silly compared to everything else that we see.
Definitely.
There is something about that loan number that he has at the very first one, which is kind of mystical seeming. And it also has the juice of it being the first time when you're like, holy crap, what's going on here? Like the juxtaposition really works right there. And it does seem maybe to be the most organically arising one of them. Because I do agree, I mean, you could shuffle the musical numbers in any order. It wouldn't really make a difference. You could even get rid of one or two or something or swap them out. And in that sense, I could see it being like a little bit predetermined about where they fit into the movie as opposed to having like a direct connection to anything that was happening.
Yeah, I love that one, right? It's very wistful. He's like serenading to the moon, and he's got that sequin, like you said, merman costume on.
And imagine if there had been no other musical numbers after that too, and that would be like this one strange thing that stuck out. I mean, that would be kind of effective too. I don't know.
I think it'd be more, but then I also love all of them, right?
I really want to get your guys' thoughts on the climax to this movie, because I feel like everything hinges on this, and it's a very strange place this goes to. Again, if you haven't seen the movie and are planning on it, you might want to tune out now. But make a long story short, our main female character finds the girl that the main male character has sex with on the porn videos unconscious in an elevator, and she drags her into her apartment, tries to wake her up, can't wake her up. She eventually gets help dragging her into a different room, and the porn shoot goes on as planned with her unconscious. And real God, this is such a strange, like, I really wasn't sure what to make of this while I was watching it. But so this long, long sequence of him having sex with this passed out porn star, and the main female character staring through the window, and they lock eyes, and they even get kind of juxtaposed with the wall between them as if he's having sex with her, but he's actually doing it with this unconscious body. And that goes on and on until suddenly he runs away from her and is able to climax, I guess, in the mouth of the girl who's standing at the window.
Oh, yeah.
And that is where we end. And I would like to get everybody's thoughts on, is this supposed to be something that is a victory for him, or is this something that is that this is the only way she was able to finally get what she had wanted, which is not really what she had in mind. What are we supposed to take away from this, Seth?
I got nothing. I have nothing. I thought it was really disturbing, the whole like having sex with the dead girl. And I don't know, any of the humor creating that vibe was like gone pretty quick. Like even if it was there for like the first like 60 seconds of this long sex scene with a dead woman was kind of taken out of the room for me.
Passed out, not dead.
Is she dead? She seems dead.
I don't think she's dead.
I feel like she's dead.
I'm pretty sure she's just unconscious, which almost worse.
Either way.
Well, definitely worse.
Yeah, they definitely show her slightly conscious, right? She's in a stupor.
Oh.
She's like either doped up or just like, I don't know, maybe she didn't get her watermelon fixed, because there's this element almost of like the watermelon specifically with this character as being almost her like lifeblood, right? Like that's why I think she freaks out in the elevator earlier.
Whoa. Okay. Maybe it is worse in a way, but yeah, it is like this pretty gross rape scene basically. And again, like any dark fun kind of gets lost pretty quick because it is just so long and kind of just like boring fucking for a long time. And I started like scrubbing forward. I was pretty bored. And then I don't know, he hops up and squirts it in her mouth at the end, just like because they had tension throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, definitely. It's the culmination for sure of that tension. There's definitely an intriguing shot, right, from the side, a peripheral shot that's got the wall between them, right? And then we have the circular grate. I do like the visual setup of the whole scene. It reminds me of like Paris, Texas. It reminds me of like a lot of films where like they end with like someone in jail where the two hands touch on glass. You have this weird latticed window that's circular, but it ends up, you know, having a space that can be penetrated, right? Pun intended, I guess. But no, it's weird. It's very dark, right?
Yeah, I hope it's not supposed to be funny because it certainly isn't.
Very thinly read that this was a critique on pornography. It's a statement of like the sort of uninhabited self, right? She feels extremely dehumanized or almost disembodied, right? Like she no longer has subjectivity, right? Yet the film crew is frantically just trying to get their shot, right? They don't care about the human beneath the skin. They just care about the image. But then there's the element of the voyeur, right? The voyeur who yearns and craves and who feels alienated watching. And she's at first, I think, haunted and terrified and horrified by it. And then there's this turning point where she seems that she's somewhat tantalized by it. That's almost even more disturbing. And so you get this gaze of the outsider and the echo of the gaze. And then you have the guy who obviously to me is like not necessarily enjoying it. He's performing and doing like a very laborious, perfunctory task that we've gathered throughout the film that he doesn't find value in. And then you get that climactic primal scream. That's the key moment to me of the voyeur, right? Of the neighbor.
That's right. She starts moaning as it's happening.
I don't know. I think that the last moment where they actually, you know, as you said, he jumps up is very cryptic, and where he goes and they finally unite, right? And we get a close up also of sweat on his back or thighs or butt or whatever. Which has to do with the water, I think, for one of the moments too where perspiration and water element comes in.
Well, and she has a tear coming down her eye too. We do get this shot of him inside her mouth and this tear coming down. Yeah, but no, I guess, I mean, it's hard for me to come away from it any other way than this being a very bleak ending, besides the circumstances that led to them being there. But that almost this was the only way for her to physically connect with him and for him to physically connect with her, maybe anybody. And definitely not the playful tone that the rest of the film had been setting up. But again, the rest of the film is very much about loneliness and isolation too. So this isn't a full out comedy necessarily that has elements like that. But I do see this going to a pretty bleak or despairing place in the end.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seemed like kind of fitting for, I don't know, our own time, where it is just everybody's watching porn. Porn is everywhere. We can like lock up in our little rooms forever and please ourselves. But what are we really wanting to do is it probably there's that person that you know, and really you want them. You don't want this screen. You don't want this like artifice. You want to do this with them. You want to have a moment with them. And he does have that. That's what that scene feels like. Maybe it's trying to say to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think so. It reminds me almost of Me, You, and Everyone We Know, right? The Miranda July film. It's almost the same year, I think, as well. Like the early aughts, early 2000s, where there was this idea of like disconnect. It was a predominant theme, especially like in indie films. And this idea of finally bridging that, or just the most basic human touch as being this magical, miraculous gesture. Like that whole film, if I don't know if either of you have seen it, to me is about like digital loneliness, right? And the perversions that come out of that and the craving for real touch, for real human fleshly touch. So it's not extremely romantic and it is very disturbing, but I don't know what to say of it. I think there is a possible reading that there is actually something slightly romantic at that ending, but I'm almost fearful saying that because I'm quite ambivalent and confused. I'm in a good way once again, though. Like, I don't feel like it's a bad confusion. I think that there's a really interesting discussion to be had also about the two endings. Like, the one thing that does, I think, tie well together is they both end very potently, right, in the realm of the senses and the wayward cloud. And one is more viscerally disturbing, right, in the realm for the senses. Yet, to me, it was more easily digested, actually, than this one, which I think is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, this is more fraught to me, and it does make me look forward to one day watching this again, knowing that that's coming, and see if there's more to tease out there as far as the worldview that this is hurtling us towards. But it definitely threw me for a loop when that all happened, and I was not sure how to process it. But I've thought about it a lot since, and yeah, I do feel like there's something there perhaps that would stand out even more seeing it again. But I would recommend it with subtitles.
All right. I sat here, I opened it up again. I'm looking at it. The two options are subtitles off or subtitles off. I clicked them both. There's no subtitles.
Yeah, I'll chime in just to back Seth up here. There was no way to get subtitles on the version that I watched, which was the same one that Mark uploaded. Probably something that got lost in the transfer to the site I probably shouldn't say out loud he uploaded it to, because I think we're breaking some kind of law.
Xhamster.com.
The lesson is that this is what happens when you don't make your movie commercially available in an easily obtainable fashion.
That's right. Capitalism wins.
It confuses Seth. Please don't do that.
I know. I don't think that's what made it slow, though, I swear.
At the very least, it couldn't have helped, but sure, you might have felt the exact same way. So, would Seth, then, you seem the most ambivalent about this film. Would you unwatch it if you could?
Yeah. I'm gonna unwatch this one. Maybe dialogue would change some things, but I don't know. Most of what I'm hearing is, like, I don't know, not very promising. As far as it adding much more, as far as it like illuminating much, except that, like, yes, there's a sci-fi plot line that is linked to why water is important, but even the sci-fi plot line is just to like call attention to water, which I was already like called, that my attention was already called to, that is like a major factor here. And its emphasis is like, you know, it's not the real world either. And I kind of already saw that being the case, that this is like in a strange place and these are not like people that I know. They're not acting like people that I know. These are sort of cartoonish human beings and cartoonish scenarios. But I don't know. It just felt very long. Like the scenes just felt like they really did go on for like way too long for me. And that wasn't much there to be had. Even when I did like get context from like the wiki page, like during and after the fact, I feel like, I don't know. And it is like, I think that's the point. It's very textural. It's more just about like the feeling of it and like the sensory aspect of it. But I just did not respond to that really. I was not engaged in that way. And maybe it was because I followed it up with such a like profoundly like sensory inducing realm of the senses movie. Like that does sometimes happen with these double features where like one really sets me up and gets me going in a certain way, and the like it can be such a like hard turn if I watch the next one. But yeah, I don't know. It felt like an interesting, playful little exercise, I guess. But it was pretty lost on me.
Well, this is interesting too, and I want Paul to have the final word. So I'll just say real quick that most of the time on this podcast too, when we disagree, it's usually you liking something and me being grump about it. So this might be our first time where you would unwatch something and I would not. So Tony, keep a tally of this.
I know. Usually it's because you are like, I wish there was more connective tissue and more themes and more like going on in here. But that's what I'm like asking for out of this one, I think. More ground to stand on. And I'm all like in the other corner usually being like, yes, hurl me into the abyss. Make me confused, please.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And that is a little bit how I felt about In the Realm of the Senses. Again, not to relitigate that. That's
mind blowing to me. I don't think we're ever right. Gonna get married.
No, not maybe. Yeah, someday far in the future. But
you think so? You really think so?
Well, I don't believe the law should be involved in our love. But
thank you.
Since In the Realm of the Senses stylistically didn't do much for me and I didn't get much else out of it, this just gave me a lot more to vibe on and to enjoy on a superficial and thematic level personally. And I kind of almost love this movie.
What?
And I'm really looking forward to going through the rest of this director's filmography, or at least some of it, probably the first part of this, and there's some other ones that sound interesting. And yeah, I think this was a great introduction to him, and I look forward to seeing more from this guy and maybe re-exploring this particular film somewhere down the line too. Who knows? Maybe we'll switch again. We could watch it together and maybe you'll come around and then I will hate it.
I sure hope so.
Yeah. And then we can get married.
Yay.
But Paul, final word.
Definitely would not unwatch it. I'm very generous though. I'm very affirmative of all films. I realize that I might have come across as an apologist for some pretty abhorrent stuff at times in these, but like I tend to find like the most charitable viewing of anything. But that said, I think these are both like radically worthwhile films. Like I think they have a lot to say. They're extremely daring. And for Taiwanese cinema, even though I don't know too much, I can't imagine this not being one of the ballsiest movies made, period. And I'm just all for people that are pushing boundaries in any way. And it wasn't boring at any point for me. I found the minimalist exposition, yet the subtle and effective world building to be more creative than like your normal quasi post-apocalyptic set or setting. And I don't know. I think that it's a little dated, this story of like, I would read it as a story of alienation and loneliness, craving touch, but it still resonated at the end, as torn as I was and disturbed as I was about some of the choices. But I don't know. I think films should disturb us. It's artifice. Life is way more disturbing. So I don't know. I would prefer to grapple and be challenged by these things through a mediated experience than through a direct experience. And so, yeah, I appreciated it. I appreciated them both. I thought I actually wildly different tonally and thematically, but equally aggressive cinematically. So thanks for having me on and inviting me to watch these both.
If nothing else, we came away, or at least I came away, with a new appreciation for watermelon and a not wanting to ever have a hard-boiled egg again. So it was really a trade-off for me.
See, I want the hard-boiled egg.
Same.
Yeah. But yeah, I really want to thank Paul and just want to plug again, Cinematic Underdogs. Do you guys have like a specific release schedule or something that's coming out soon? that people can check out?
Yeah, we come out every 2 weeks with a new episode, pretty much on the dot. Our next one is California Split.
Oh, nice!
I love California Split.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite little game movies.
So yeah, like I said, we definitely explore the margins of that genre, but you can find us at like Anchor or Spotify or whatever. As Mark said, I'm on Letterboxd and I'll review everything there. That's me. It's me and my buddy, right? But I'm behind the avatars or the Twitter or everything. So he shows up for the pod and we chat. But yeah, so if you want to interact, just look me up on any platforms. But yeah, please check. I would say check out our next one. It's a fun one. We already recorded it. It's just got to get edited and put out there. And yeah, for this audience, I think it would work. I mean, it's an Altman movie and it's one of Altman's finest larks, right? It's a little fun ditty, but man, is it unforgettable.
Totally.
All right. Yeah, we will link to that then in the episode description for this. And if you can tell anything from this conversation, obviously his podcast, whether or not you're super into sports or sports movies, you're going to get a thoughtful discussion out of it.
We'll have to start planning the Unwatchables sports movie edition. Maybe we can have you back someday to find the nastiest ones out there to sit through.
Well, yeah, we need your help with that.
Yeah, man. Remember the Titans is some gross shit.
Disturbing. Yeah, quite disturbing.
Unwatchables is produced by Tony Scarpitti. Hosted by me, Mark D'Ottavio, and Seth Troyer, with artwork by Micah Krause. You can find Seth and I on Letterboxd under Mark D'Ottavio and Sloth Troyer. You can also check us out at unwatchablespod.com for links to our Twitter and Instagram, or support us on Patreon for bonus content and to have a say in what we watch. Thanks for listening.